Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour has written many books over the past 20 years on the history of American conservatism since the 1950s. We are tempted during a major election to look for historical parallels. Was this presidential election just like 1968 or 1972 or 64 or 76 or way before? He will be answering that question during the course of this hour. Rick Perlstein is our guest. He's also written a very interesting piece, which I want to spend some time talking about, concerning what he calls the bad journalism that was a part of the 2016 campaign. Rick is a historian and author. His recent book is the New York Times bestseller, The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan. And his other books have looked at the rise of Richard Nixon and Barry Goldwater. He's written extensively, and his work has appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, Washington Post, The Nation, The Village Voice, Slate. He's received a National Endowment for the Humanities grant for independent scholars, and he grew up right here in Milwaukee. So we're delighted to have him with us this hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. Our email, as always, is talk@WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Rick, hello. Thanks for being with us again. Hi.
Hi. Kathleen. Always great to be with you.
Yeah, wonderful to have you here. So is this presidential election we've just been through, and what a doozy it has been, just like some other year or not?
I think it's like no other year. People, I think, in times of confusion, reach to the past, just like we, you know, reach for our favorite comfort foods when we're confused and anxious in our own lives. And, you know, that's understandable. But I think history at heart is the study of both continuity and change. And the challenge before us now is both to understand the historical forces and individuals which made Trump possible, but also to grasp at the same time what makes Trump and the situation we're in so extraordinary. Mm-hmm. I give the example of, you know, when we think about our friends and loved ones and try and think about what made them who they are, yes, obviously their families play an enormous role, in their parents, and, you know, their DNA in creating their identities and what they look like and what they act like. But we also are creations of ourselves as well. I think we need to bind those two forces together, too, to make sense of the really remarkable and ultimately, I think, in many ways, unprecedented situation we're in now.
Mm-hmm. You said in a recent piece that we need to think more about the Republican Party as an institution and less about Trump as an individual.
That's partially true, although I think this will be a very both and sort of interview. We need to think of Trump as an individual, too. But let's, you know, look at the Republican Party, which in the middle of the last century was a coalition of liberals and conservatives. Many of the liberals in the Republican Party were to the left of John F. Kennedy. There was a process in which the conservative movement basically took over the party from the ground up. And one of the features about conservatism that's so important to understand is that it sees the world often in apocalyptic terms, that we're fighting for last things, for civilizational stakes. And, you know, I write about that process of the conservative takeover as a historian, but as a journalist since the 1990s, I've been writing about that kind of apocalypticism's effect on our political institutions. I would begin with the sort of rhetoric we heard in 1994 when Newt Gingrich's conservative revolutionaries took over Congress, and the pollster and consultant, Luntz, what was his first name, came up with a memo about what language conservative Republican candidates should use when campaigning against Democrats. And there was all sorts of, you know, nasty words, dehumanizing words. So by 1995, which is the year in which, of course, the Oklahoma City federal building was bombed by an anti-government extremist, you heard right-wing talk radio hosts like G. Gordon Liddy talking about, you know, the proper way to shoot agents of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in 1998, you have the impeachment of Bill Clinton by an out-of-control prosecutor who was, you know, given the job of investigating Whitewater. One of the most striking watersheds in this for me as a journalist was going to California in 2003 and covering the recall campaign against Gray Davis. Gray Davis had been elected against a Republican who got about 40% of the votes, and the campaign against him was largely led by quite hysteric talk radio hosts who said things like Gray Davis wants to give Mexican-American undocumented immigrants driver's licenses. The real reason was, of course, if you don't have a driver's license, you don't drive safely. You know, you might drive too slow, you might avoid the police. But these guys argued that it was in order to give them the vote so that Mexican illegal immigrants, so that California would become, and this is a quote, the northernmost province of Mexico. And, you know, this went kind of on and on and on through the Tea Party, in which we saw all the absolutely absurd extremist rhetoric about, you know, death panels and Barack Obama not being born in the United States.
Right.
So as far as the institution of the Republican Party, and I would say the apotheosis of it is Mitch McConnell literally saying we shouldn't investigate the quite strong possibility that the Russians were sabotaging our election, which, of course, is the foundation of our democracy, because that would be a partisan. He said Obama was trying to do something that was partisan. So, you know, Trump is the bitter fruit of, in many ways, what has become a quite poisoned tree.
Mm. And Mitch McConnell changed his mind, evidently. Something's growing in that regard, I think.
Is that the news today? I didn't catch that.
He this morning he said that you know we're not friends with the Russians, and he called for a Senate investigation.
That's quite interesting.
Isn't it?
With the chief executive Donald Trump saying that he doesn't trust anything the CIA says, and the Washington Post, because we're going to get to the media portion of this, printing without any comment his transition team's statement that after all he won one of the biggest electoral college majorities in history, which is an outright lie.
Yeah. So when you look at him, I found this intriguing. You wrote that we need to begin broadening the discussion when we're looking at who Trump is and what era we're in. We need to look at Europe's experience mm-hmm. with fascism if we really want to understand Donald Trump. We do?
Oh, absolutely. And people are doing it. I'm hard at work on a very long essay for the New York Times Magazine about what professional historians have done to help us understand Trump, but how they've failed in their histories of conservatism to help us understand Trump. So I've surveyed all sorts of historians who've done what I've done, not as well as we could have, in writing the history of the conservative movement, and pretty much, you know, ignoring what was going on, say, in the 1920s when the Ku Klux Klan had literally 4 million members and pretty much, you know, ran the state of Indiana. You know, 1939, there was a Nazi rally in Madison Square Garden with a giant backdrop of George Washington beneath a Nazi eagle. You know, they packed Madison Square Garden to the gills. You know, there were anti-Jewish pogroms in New York and Boston during World War II. There, of course, is the experience of McCarthyism. And when it comes to Europe, well, of course, the alt-right, which we've heard so much about in recent months, has pretty much a free transit back and forth with the far-right politicians of Europe who come from what we thought, again, I emphasize what we thought, was a completely foreign right-wing tradition to the United States of ethno-nationalism, in which people who are not white are not considered legitimate legitimate members of the polity that has been a lot less interested than American conservatives in laissez-faire economics. So we see that feature of Donald Trump's conservatism, perhaps honored in the breach, but at least coming from a tradition that seemed to have been foreign to America. And you have a whole tradition of analysis of the people to whom fascism appealed to in Europe in the 20s and 30s. And you have figures like Hannah Arendt, the great Jewish German emigre intellectual, who said absolutely brilliant things about how authoritarians cloud reality and cloud truth and intentionally create a mediascape in which no one knows what is true and what is false, with the goal of making it impossible for anyone to come up with any sort of objective accounts of the truth, which paves the way for the demagogue, the authoritarian leader, to define truth for himself. And, you know, I defy anyone to look at the role that fake news placed in this election, the role that Donald Trump's lie that Barack Obama was not born in America, just what I just referred to, that his literally the organization of transition of the president-elect just baldly lies about his electoral mandate. And you have millions of people willing to accept this as right. gospel. I saw a recent poll that, for example, I think it was 62% believe that George Soros, the billionaire Jewish financier, was paying people to protest against Donald Trump. Mm. So when you have that sort of degradation of information and truth, it's very similar to what was going on in Weimar Germany when they talked about the idea that Jewish Bolsheviks and Jewish bankers had conspired to stab Germany in the back during World War One.
So do you think then, Rick, that Donald Trump has been very calculated in these decisions to question the legitimacy of President Obama as an American citizen, to begin his campaign by talking about Mexicans who are rapists, to
right.
all of that? What's the grand purpose of doing all of this?
Right. Well, as George Bush used to say, I can't see into his heart, right? I don't know
right.
what motivates him. But here's what we do know, as a matter of fact. Then when he was preparing to run for president, he spent enormous amounts of time listening to right-wing talk radio. Mm. And again, this is where we need to understand the institutions of the right and how they inform what has happened. And he picked up their narratives in order to appeal to those listeners. And so certainly his ability to kind of go where the other Republican candidates weren't willing to go, that level of irresponsible demagoguery, was based on a plan, you know, on intention. I think that that's very hard to deny.
Mm-hmm. It's also hard to figure out in these days. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are about all these financial interests that he's mm-hmm. got all over the world, and
right.
bringing in his daughter for the Japanese prime minister.
The
she's
CEO
got a
of
business
Exxon,
going
which has
on.
Had a basically a parallel foreign policy to the United
yeah.
States.
Is
and
it
his predecessor, as CEO of Exxon, said that he's not interested in making decisions in the interests of the United States.
So money is part of it, making more money.
That's certainly near and dear to Donald Trump's heart. We have his own testimony to that effect. Right, but it's also a vision of the world. How does the world work? You know, he fetishizes what he calls deals, right? So what many of us would consider disqualifying for high office in the federal government, which would be, you know, conflicts of interest or lots of business interests that their decisions as government officials could affect, he sees as their core qualifications, that they're good at making deals. So, you know, it shouldn't be surprising that he chooses as his labor secretary, you know, the CEO of a fast food restaurant. Just to give an example of, you know, how he understands the process of making deals. and this speaks to, I think, a failure of the Clinton campaign in not putting stuff like this to the fore. In 2015, he gave a speech in Michigan in which he said that the car companies should be willing to move their plants around to places outside of Michigan, and then the officials in Michigan would be so desperate to get them back that they'd be willing to, you know, lower the unions, and the government officials would be willing to accept lower wages. And he literally said that Michigan would be able to get, quote, great deals. Now, on the one hand, that shows his, you know, shocking ignorance, because, of course, car plants have been moving to the South, you know, at least since the 1970s. But on the other hand, it shows how if you get the better of someone in a negotiation, that makes you, in Donald Trump's eyes, basically a genius. Mm.
Let's get your thoughts on this before we move into a media discussion, which I also found that article fascinating. What do you make of this whole Russian hacking thing? Do you think that there's an investigation that's going to be serious and give us important information? Are we going to see the light of day about how this happened and how influential it was? And it just seems to me as though it has the potential of being very large, Rick.
I can't think of anything that has the potential to be larger. The integrity of our elections is the integrity of our nation, right? And the integrity of our democracy and the integrity of our sovereignty as a country. We don't talk a lot about American sovereignty unless we're far right wingers, you know, talking about, you know, Mexican immigrants or something like that. But it's a very serious question now. One of the problems in evaluating this is we do have this enormous secret intelligence apparatus. And as we all know now, there are 17 separate intelligence agencies in the United States.
Unbelievable. 17 of them.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And by, you know, at least one account, they all are in accord that Russia was behind this. But the FBI has seemed to have demurred, dissented from this conclusion. But then again, when we talk about the degradation of American institutions, the FBI also has plainly done what Russia did, which is interfere with the integrity of an election by, you know, having these investigations of Hillary Clinton that could have went on secretly and privately, but James Comey chose instead to publicize, even though they amounted to veritably nothing. So, you know, we can say for the argument, let's say that the intelligence agencies, you know, have, in fact, nailed Russia dead to rights. Well, what we have is, in the case of McConnell, which sounds like too little, too late, someone who was willing to overlook that for partisan gain. We have a Republican establishment that, you know, is not raising a peep. They seem more intimidated by Donald Trump than seeing themselves as a check and a balance against his abuses. We have a president who, if everything we're hearing is correct, knew about all of this before the election and chose not to say anything.
Right.
I think that historically that could be an enormous blot on his record and all that he accomplished, and a real, let's say it's a confirmation of those who suspected that Obama's very way of thinking about the world, that Americans are united and at peace with itself, there's no red America, there's no blue America, he has honest broker negotiating partners among the Republican Party, that very ideology of his, that very ideal, may well lay around us as smoking ruins. And if the worst happens, that America is seriously under threat as a republic, Barack Obama's inability to break some eggs may bear some striking responsibility.
Fascinating. Well, we're going to welcome phone calls, and we have yet to talk about the press, and we'll get into that in a moment. He wrote a very, very interesting piece, The Hucksters, Hustlers, Hucksters, Hacks, and Cowards Who Helped Elect Donald Trump, and he's referring to bad journalism. So we'll talk about bad journalism as we continue. We have so much going on here. We were starting our conversation with, are there historical references? Do we need to understand Donald Trump by looking at 1968 or fascism in Europe or whatever else we have lived before? what informs him. What do we need to be informed by in order to understand what's going on right now? And we'll move into journalism. And we were talking about this some last hour, if there will be, because you would think there are emails around and there could be some really excellent investigative reporting. And I would think there's somebody now at some newspaper or elsewhere who's looking into this Russian hacking. Or does Rick have faith that that's going to happen or not? Well, we welcome your phone calls, and here's how you reach us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. And Rick Perlstein is our guest, a historian and author. Most recent book is the New York Times bestseller, The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan. He's written other books on Richard Nixon and on Barry Goldwater. He's a very prolific writer. He is writing a piece right now for the New York Times Magazine, you heard him say. And he's from here. So, to you momentarily, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Two phone calls for Rick. We start with Scott in La Crosse. Hello, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi, Scott.
I would like to ask the guest, at one of his recent victory tour, or thank you tour rallies, I heard words to this effect from the president-elect. He said, my selection for Secretary of Defense, General Mattis, is going to get a waiver. And then he said, he better get a waiver, or people are going to get really angry.
Mm-hmm.
And as I'm listening to this, I'm thinking, okay, here is the president-elect telling a GOP-controlled Congress that they better give his selection for Secretary of Defense a waiver, or people are going to be upset. And as I'm listening, I'm thinking, now wait a minute. You got basically what he's saying is to Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, you better give me my way, or I'm going to stick my machine on you. So my question is, at what point do people who I'm assuming have probably pretty good-sized egos themselves in Congress think, you know, this is one threat too many?
That's a really interesting question. The people who run the, you know, what we think of as the Republican Party establishment have proven extraordinarily craven. You know, here's a historical parallel that I would point to. In 1964, when Barry Goldwater scared the bejesus out of the Republican establishment, most of them refused to campaign for him. But as we know, thinking of people like Mitt Romney, thinking of people like Chris Christie, they've turned themselves into compliant puppy dogs. When it comes to someone like Paul Ryan or Boehner or Mitch McConnell, I think of a quotation from the Republican activist, conservative, anti-tax extremist, Grover Norquist. He said a while ago, well, all we want out of a Republican president is someone with a functioning right arm in order to send sign the legislation that we send to him. So that's the bargain that someone like Paul Ryan thinks he's striking with Donald Trump. Paul Ryan has, as your listeners all know, has been working for quite a few years on, you know, a complete wiring of the American welfare state. He's been, you know, biding his time for this moment in which he can, you know, slash things like the social safety net, like Social Security, like Medicare. So his bargain is that, you know, Donald Trump will go along with him on that. And, you know, the evidence is that, you know, he may be right in certain respects. The fact that Donald Trump, you know, promised not to truck with the Republican establishment and this kind of stuff, but has been quite aggressively, you know, outsourcing his Supreme Court picks to the Heritage Foundation and things like that. But on the other side, these guys think that they can control this guy.
I don't think so. Do you?
Do I think that they can control? No,
right.
I don't.
No.
And so I think that they're going to find themselves in a very difficult position because he's so mercurial. he's so vengeful. And, you know, as, I have a piece coming out in the New Republic that I just saw the print edition of. It's not online yet. Donald Trump is going to have the full surveillance apparatus of the American state, which Obama shamefully presided over its growth. Who knows what kind of dirt he's going to get on a Paul Ryan in the way that, you know, J. Edgar Hoover got dirt on every politician and was able to control him that way. So, yeah, we have a Donald Trump who is proving himself willing to single out, say, a union leader in Indiana, and then he gets death threats. We have a Donald Trump whose deputies who have gone after, you know, the Fox News reporter, Megyn Kelly, who was at one point very aggressive about questioning Donald Trump. And now she says in her memoir that a Fox News executive literally had to call a Trump official and say, you got to call off your dogs because if this woman gets murdered, it's not going to be good for your candidate. And now apparently we see him crossing the threshold of making the same kind of threats, and I think the caller is correct. This is a threat to someone like Paul Ryan. He has no filter when it comes to this kind of stuff. So I think that it's quite possible that the Paul Ryans of the world might find themselves with a mess of pottage on their hands.
Have you, your piece on the press and how they cover the campaign led me to think you had read Megyn Kelly's book. I'd love to interview her. Is it good? She was amazing during this campaign, wasn't she?
You know, I haven't had a chance. I would love, Kathleen, and maybe you're the one to do it, I would love to have someone ask Megyn Kelly. And I know she was scheduled to do an interview with Terry Gross, and I saw that it didn't run, so I don't know what happened with that.
Really?
I would love to see someone ask Megyn Kelly, you know, as a citizen, as a journalist whose primary responsibility to is to informing the public and informing their decisions in a democracy, if you do believe that that's a journalist's prime responsibility, why did you wait to reveal these things until after the election when it came time to promote your book? Mm-hmm. That's pretty sickening.
And there were some terrible things. This one story, some of these things you go, are you kidding me? She was on her way to do the debate. You read this story, perhaps, and she was in the car, and the driver of the car, they were taking her from Fox to the debate, and he said, oh, I want to get you a cup of coffee. Let's get a cup of coffee. No, I don't want any. I don't want any. She said, I've had coffee this morning. He kept insisting, and she drank a cup of coffee while she was in the limo, and a half hour later, she was sick as a dog. She was vomiting all over the place. They didn't know if she would be able to do the debate that night because she was so sick. She did it with a garbage can next to her.
Oh, my God.
Isn't that incredible?
Now, let me say something about that story, by the way. One of the things that authoritarians do is they all turn us into paranoids. And paranoids are not very good at making rational and strategic and tactical decisions. So let's assume the possibility that that's true. Yes, that's really, really scary. That it's true that somehow that her coffee was poisoned.
Right.
That's really scary because, of course, that's what Putin has done to journalists.
Right.
Let's assume that it was completely a coincidence.
Yes, right, which it could have been.
You know, I would be pretty nervous if I had to, you know, face Donald Trump in a debate and I was over-caffeinated, you know. So suddenly we get completely wrapped up in this question about what the nature of reality is, right? You know, when the FBI... When the FBI wanted to go after, you know, black power leaders and the Black Panthers, what they would do is they would infiltrate one of the groups and spread false rumors about another one of the groups. So no one knew what was true. So no one knew whether this person who was a government informant or someone who was just a traitor to the group for other reasons. And, you know, the Black Panthers once, you know, tortured someone to death who they were convinced was he a government, he was a government informant. Was he a government informant? Who knows? This inability to trust each other. Mm-hmm. And this is where the Hannah Arendt stuff comes in. You know, this atomization of society in which all the bonds of mutual respect break down because we don't know what's true and what is not true is one of the most subtle and dangerous things that an authoritarian can do to a society. And clearly, we're already there. He didn't have to poison Megyn Kelly for us to entertain the possibility that maybe he's poisoning people, right? And suddenly, you know, we're all a Twitter about that.
Yeah. Well, the whole thing, his whole rise to national prominence, the president was not born in the United States. Was
right.
this true? Was this not true? A lot of people believe that for
years. Hey, man,
years.
I haven't seen the birth certificate, right?
Exactly. For years and years.
That's right.
Scott, thanks so much for your always great questions. Annie in Appleton, hi.
Yeah, hi there. Speaking about reality, first of all, your show is just great here. My comment is that the role of the media in either validating or helping to create this alternative mm-hmm. reality of the right
yeah.
is probably the biggest source of frustration for most people, because
yeah.
if it wasn't for NPR and articulate and brave people like you, I don't think we would even have any truth in the media at all.
Yes, and I even
grew
went
up
after
in
NPR
the years
in my
where
article.
They used to talk about Radio Free Europe, you know, and I the propaganda machine of this country is just it's overwhelming.
Yes. Let me say a few things about the media. I've taken to, because this stuff is so depressing and scary, and it almost makes us all want to throw our hands up in the air and give up, which is the last thing I want to encourage. One of the exciting things about focusing on the media as an important actor in this role is that the media is full of kind of intelligent, educated people who will respond to pressure from other intelligent, educated people. So we have examples where, you know, misleading headlines have been changed. We have ombudsmen at places like the New York Times. You can tweet at journalists. And in my article, singled out actually a report on Morning Edition as
right.
something that was quite offensive. You know, they giggled about Michael Flynn as a fun guy and didn't talk about, you know, his mainstreaming of anti-Muslim conspiracy theories. My main point about journalism is not that it's fundamentally broken. My main point about journalism in the age of Trump is that it's at the razor's edge. They have done, they are doing, and they will do outstanding investigations. The Washington Post wrote a terrible headline about how wonderful it was that Trump had a diverse cabinet, you know, and he was talking about, you know, Nikki Haley as his UN ambassador, even though Nikki Haley has no foreign policy experience. He was talking about Betsy DeVos as his education secretary, even though Betsy DeVos is basically, brothers of Eric Prince and married into the family that runs Amway, which is a pyramid scheme and is guilty of all sorts of frauds and has no experience in education, but they're women and Nikki Haley's a minority. And on the other hand, the Washington Post has had David Farenthold, who has done absolutely stunning investigations of Donald Trump's foundation as a money laundering scheme. So I feel like the press could go either way, and we as citizens have a role in encouraging them. Now, that said, there are press organs that have behave so scandalously that they may be beyond saving. And I have to single out CNN, which literally has chosen the Trump campaign as a business model. And we have, you know, testimony to that effect. They fired all their Republican commentators and hired ones who are friendly to Trump so they could have more entertaining debates on the air. They have constantly just shown Trump rallies for, you know, hours at a time without commentary
yes,
or interruption. Where are the Obama speeches? I remember I was watching a fascinating Obama speech sometime in, you know, 2010 or 2011 on the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. And I thought it was amazing. Here I am watching CNN, and they're showing an Obama speech, which you never see. And then suddenly they broke away to show this balloon that supposedly had this kid had flown up in the air. And
oh, yes, I remember that story. They followed that balloon all afternoon.
Yes,
right.
And it turned out to be a hoax, right?
Yeah.
So CNN... which, by the way, the president of which used to be the president of the company that signed up Trump for The Apprentice, right, has been, you know, absolutely obscene. And, you know, the head of CBS, Les Moonves, has said, you know, this is really fun and we're making a ton of money, right? So this is kind of scandalous behavior.
Yeah.
But there are outstanding journalists at the places like the New York Times and the Washington Post and NPR, and there are journalists who are so married to the professional ideology of balance that they basically are not depicting reality. And the reality, again, as I described it using Hannah Arendt, is that when truth is optional, when disinformation is intentional, you cannot report Trump said this and the other side says this. You have to make the story that Trump is trying to confuse people.
Well, I think that many of them are feeling guilty because they didn't see this election. They didn't see this coming. Nobody
saw
it
coming. Well, that's another example, too, right?
Yeah, they feel like they're, whoa, we forgot about white working class people in all these places in the country, and shame on us. And
well, they also forgot about black working class people, right? Where was the profiles of them?
Right. Yeah. Well, this was a group who didn't like what a lot of the press was doing anyhow. They felt totally ignored, that the black people were getting a lot more press than they were.
Yes. Yes. A lot of the Trump voters, of course, if you ask them, you know, what are the realities about, you know, who is getting more privilege in society, if a pollster asks them, they'll say, oh, black people get a lot more stuff than white people.
Yes.
Right. Right. Absolutely false, but it's certainly a true, it's true that they have that perception. So the press has often been willing to report the perceptions of Trump supporters as a fact, which is true that they perceive that, without going the extra step and, you know, providing the context. Just like in the case of, you know, Hillary Clinton's emails, yes, she erased 22,000 emails, I'm sorry, 33,000 emails that she claimed were personal. Let's see that in the context, the absolutely crucial context, that every Secretary of State has used a private email service for their communications, and that the George W. Bush administration erased 22 million official emails, including those under subpoena. That kind of context was almost always missing.
Mm-hmm. And as you remind us, and now we have Donald Trump in one of your latest articles, elected in part because of his alleged tender concern for the secure handling of intelligence, making
right.
calls to world leaders from Trump Tower's unsecured telephones.
Right, among other things.
Let's go to Todd in Appleton. Hi, Todd.
Hi, I really enjoy this conversation and listening to it. First of all, I'm in my 70s, and I'm conservative, and I'm a history nut, so I read a lot of history stuff. I think one of the problems we have, too, is a lack of knowledge of American history by a lot of folks. And what that does, then, is it makes us, a lot of folks, more gullible to the misinformation.
Yeah.
And if you were to look back on the history of other presidents, say, for instance, the Grant administration.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you want to see corruption on a large scale. There it was. So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that in some ways will make Donald Trump look like a Boy Scout. But on the other hand, I'm a little concerned about how everyone seems to be falling in line now that he's the president-elect. And I don't know. I kind of admire the history of our republic being able to question stuff on a constant basis, and I hope that continues.
Yes. You know, people call the president the commander-in-chief. I don't have a commander-in-chief. He's the commander-in-chief of the military. That's what the Constitution says. You know, our founders profoundly intended us to question our leaders. There's a famous story that Thomas Jefferson, when he was receiving the French ambassador, strewn across the antechamber of his executive office all sorts of newspaper accounts of what a scoundrel Thomas Jefferson was. And I don't know, Kathleen, have you ever heard our friend John Nichols tell this story? And the French ambassador comes in and says, Mr. President, do you see these awful things they're writing about you? What are you going to do about it? And, of course, Thomas Jefferson said nothing. You know, America, you know, we encourage that sort of criticism of the president. And he also said, I'd rather have a newspaper without a government than a government without a newspaper.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm so glad to hear, speaking of history, that to have so many callers from Appleton, which, of course, is the hometown of our own Joe McCarthy.
Absolutely.
And, the home base of the John Birch Society. So it's great to hear folks in Appleton who are exercising their citizenship duties.
Yeah, Joe McCarthy fighting Bob, you know, not in Appleton, but that's Wisconsin.
Yeah.
That's it. And somebody did call, just so that both of us, because I wasn't aware of this either, we can listen to it. Megyn Kelly was on Fresh Air on December 10th.
Okay, great. I'll have to listen to that.
I
you know,
too.
I'm glad to be corrected, unlike Donald Trump.
Let's take more phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. You are listening to the Ideas Network. Rick Perlstein is our guest this hour, historian and author. Most recent book is the New York Times bestseller, The Invisible Bridge. He has been studying the conservatives in this country for over 20 years now. Other books have looked at Richard Nixon and Barry Goldwater, and he's here to talk about so many things in this age of Donald Trump. Carol in Sullivan, Wisconsin. Hi, Carol.
Oh, hi, Kathleen and guests. I have an interesting story. I have two wonderful friends who I've known for many years. They're both were born in Germany. They're in their 80s, and they lived when Hitler was coming in.
Oh, wow.
And one said to me, when I talked with her, she said, "I'm voting for Trump." And I went, "Okay." And then it was maybe a several months later, she said, "Oh, no," she said, "I just about had a nightmare." She said, "It was like deja vu all over again because the people were down and jobs weren't coming fast enough." And so they just clamored for this man who was making all these promises to them. And then I have another German friend who's in her 80s. She did not come to America until she was 15. And she said it was awful. It was just awful. And if people can just get this message out that it's terrible what this man has said and done.
Do you see comparisons here, or are we on shaky ground when we make such comparisons?
Well, you know, Trump isn't Hitler. Trump isn't Wallace. Trump isn't Nixon. Trump is Trump. But, you know, the patterns, I think, are certainly the extraordinary promises that the authoritarian leader makes for the restoration of national glory, and the idea of sort of like this cleansing wind that is going to like extirpate all corruption. And that seduction is so dangerous in the hands of someone who is paranoid and vengeful precisely because it's impossible to fulfill, right? He's not going to be able to bring back coal jobs. Right, he's not going to be able to restore all the factories back to the United States. You know, he's not probably, you know, unless he's willing to, you know, have goon squads in every corner, be able to kick 12 million people out of the country. So what happens to these tens of millions of people who revere this guy and treat his every word as holy writ when these things do not happen? When he's unable to fulfill his promises, are they going to blame him? Are they going to blame themselves? Well, people are not very good at blaming themselves. You know, the human mind is a rationalizing machine. Donald Trump is going to give them scapegoats to blame. You know, he's going to blame the liberal media. You know, he's going to blame the establishment in both parties. He's going to, we've already seen him blaming Paul Ryan. And that's when you get forces that the rest of us may not be able to control, which are masses of people who feel betrayed in their very essence. Does that mean that there's going to be death camps and 6 million minorities are going to be slaughtered? You know, I don't think so. But does that have to happen for us to be afraid for the very character of our republic? I don't think so either. You know, there was Hitler. There was, you know, Salazar. There was Mussolini. You know, there was Pinochet in Chile. There's all sorts of authoritarians on a scale, right? And the fact of the matter is we've never seen this a demagoguery so pure from a leader of the Republican Party. Mm.
So, Rick, let's talk about the Democrats for a moment. Mm-hmm. And granted, there was a whole lot of information about Hillary's emails, crooked Hillary, lock her up. But she really wasn't the best of candidates, obviously. She lost to Donald Trump, and people didn't like her very much for a whole host of reasons in this country. So what is the message to counter, and what the heck happened to the Democratic Party? Right. What are they going to do from here on out?
Right. One of the things I find myself returning to is that the Democrats, really their social base, their especially the way of thinking of the people who lead the party in Washington, really is this kind of upper middle class professionalism. And if you look at the fundamental strategy of the Hillary Clinton campaign from the beginning. Think of that teeny little slogan, "I'm with her," right? It was the idea of I'm in this club of
right-thinking
people.
Right, yes, yes.
You know, it was a very smug little slogan. And if you think of their foundational strategy, the fact is she had all sorts of amazing programs for the white middle class. I mean, the white working class, things like, you know, paid family leave and et cetera, et cetera. Just like, you know, Barack Obama had all sorts of wonderful programs to restore manufacturing. But one of the reasons that wasn't able to be communicated was what they chose to do with their TV commercials, and their main message was this very upper-middle-class professional message that Donald Trump was rude. Donald Trump was not polite. And the way a lot of people heard that was, sure, he's going to be a SOB, but he's going to be our SOB. Right. And maybe they even were refreshed that he was able to say things that they weren't able to say. So it was a message that was very strongly resonant with people in, frankly, my social class. But I've long said that Democrats do best when they think of universal economic aspirations for the middle class. And that doesn't mean selling out the civil rights legacy of the Democratic Party. It means building a coalition. And remember how close the election was. Remember how close it was in Wisconsin.
Right.
If they were going to get, you know, the whatever it is, 50,000, 90,000 people in the strategic counties that they needed into Hillary Clinton's camp, well, what if they had TV commercials about how Donald Trump was ripping off tradesmen? You know, what if they had TV commercials about how Donald Trump said he it would be great if the car companies could figure out a way to, you know, lower the wages of car workers? That just wasn't the foundation of Hillary Clinton's campaign. You know, it really was the foundation of Barack Obama's campaign. You know, that Mitt Romney was basically raped middle class Americans by being a private equity guy. You know, it turned out to be, although I don't think this was necessarily his intention in the first place, Barack Obama's strongest message against John McCain, when John McCain, after the crash, said the fundamentals of the economy are strong. That kind of message is not going to get, you know, like 80% or 70% or 60% or even, you know, 55 or 51% of the white working class in America. But it'll get more of the white working class mm-hmm. in America. And for the Democrats to be able to remember that, they need to there's a word from sociology you don't hear a lot anymore that I've been using a lot. It's over-socialized, you know, sort of overly polite, overly other-directed. That, you know, basically they need to expand their strategic thinking beyond that sort of upper-middle-class style of thought. And I think it's, you know, quite possible. There's plenty of leaders in the Democratic Party, Sherrod Brown in Ohio. I think of course, Elizabeth Warren, who speak in that register. And they just need more voice in party councils.
Zach in Waupaca. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think these are crazy times we're living in. And one of the issues I've been struggling with is there's so much inconsistency with our media, depending upon who owns them or how their organization is run. And I think we really need a rededication to integrity and quality in reporting. And anyone who can't subscribe to that shouldn't be called news. It should be called editorial.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I'm really having a hard time with is how do you stay on top of all this stuff? I've been trying to read as much as I can from all the different news outlets that I can, and there's all kinds of discrepancies among them, and it's to the point where, you know, I'm looking at the news feed on my phone, and I'm wondering, how do I know that this isn't coming from some kind of espionage,
right.
you know,
right.
random fake news with,
right.
you know, real, you know, logos on it?
Who do you trust, Zach? Or, I mean, who do you trust, Rick?
Who do I trust?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I trust the media institutions that, you know, I write for. You know, I mean, there's a great, strong, progressive, independent media in this country that's going to be, you know, basically risking their necks to fight Trump. You know, I write for Mother Jones. I write for The New Republic. I write for The Nation. I've never written for The Progressive in Madison, but they're outstanding. I write for In These Times, which is based in Chicago. And, you know, there's actually some integrity in the conservative press. I think of the American Conservative. I think of Reason Magazine, which is a libertarian magazine. A lot of the conservative media has kind of fallen prey to a lot of the craziness we've thought of. The National Review has claimed themselves never Trump, but they really kind of went the way of conspiracy theories after William F. Buckley died. So they're not particularly reliable. There's also, when it comes to fake news, there's some sort, I wish I had it at the tip of my tongue, but there's a resource online where you can which is coming up with a list of fake news outlets.
Oh, that's good to know about.
Maybe Rick, we can all both research that and broadcast it.
All right. Yeah, we'll let people know on Facebook. Thanks, Rick, so much for being with us.
Oh, it went by in a second.
I know it did. Yeah, thank you. Rick Perlstein, historian and author. Look for his latest piece in the New York Times Magazine. His bestseller most recently is The Invisible Bridge. He's a historian of the conservatives in this country, and first book was on Barry Goldwater. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, to Zeb Gozman for on-air production here in Milwaukee. Thanks for listening and for your many phone calls. Sorry we couldn't get to all of them. Put your messages on Facebook and we'll read what you have said over the air. Until mañana.